Okay, welcome, Mohsen.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good to talk to you again on our fantastic piece of string and two sets of cans across the channel. How was it Paris today?
Paris is pretty cold. So pretty damn freezing.
Yeah. So is London. You're really not that far away. Okay. We're today going to talk about the very, very popular, almost instantly iconic U.S. President-elect Barack Obama. Basically, you've written in your blog, The Daily Mohsen, a somewhat controversial, from some people's point of view, article about the U.S. President-elect.
Yeah.
And it's called Barack Obama, War Criminal in Waiting. Before we get into the detail, the nitty-gritty of what really motivated you to write that article in the first place and to call it what you have called it?
Well, I guess I can address that question by actually looking at one of your premises, which is that it's a controversial article. I actually don't think it is a controversial article. I think that it was at the time of writing published the 5th of November. It was written, most of it, before then. And at that time, everyone was going crazy about him, that he was really, a real sort of a new impulse, a new phenomenon, something completely different from the past, a real break from standard Washington behavior and policies and so on and so forth. But it's really interesting that facade melted away so quickly after the election. I mean, to the extent that even 2 weeks after, 2 weeks, the 18th of November, 2 weeks after the election, even the BBC ran an article stating, is Barack Obama just Bill Clinton all over again? Ran an article stating that. Now, if you had said that a week before the election, I mean, no one would have taken you seriously. And so the article was basically a response to this sort of mass hysteria that there was around Obama that was based essentially on absolutely nothing, because all the evidence that we'd seen up to that point was stating what we know now and what was admitted on the BBC just 2 weeks after the election, which is that he doesn't represent any change whatsoever. He represents a shift across a spectrum, across a political spectrum, from Republican to Democrat, from mainstream right to mainstream left, possibly. But in terms of real change, absolutely not at all. He represents change within the political spectrum, but real fundamental change, absolutely not.
Yeah, it's almost like, if you're navigating a yacht or something, the objective of where you're trying to get to doesn't really change, but your route might be altered slightly.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the framework of how far either way you can go is very, very tightly set. And the people who are supporting Obama seem to have this, all the people who are really enthused about Obama seem to have the feeling that he was really going to break through these parameters and break through this sort of standard framework and do something really new and revolutionary. The point was that there was absolutely nothing to suggest that this was going to be the case at all. And the more that the campaign went on, the more obvious this was the case, the more that he went from the left to the center and even to the right on certain positions. He abandoned his positions with such rapidity and with such almost enthusiasm and such ease that it was pretty obvious to anyone who was watching, and had an inch of perspective that this wasn't going to be any sort of real fundamental change in Washington politics.
So what made you decide to call it Barack Obama, War Criminal in Waiting?
Okay, well, it's based on the famous line from Noam Chomsky, which is that if the Nuremberg laws were properly applied, every post-war U.S. president would be hanged. The notion being that under the Nuremberg principles, every single president since, including Roosevelt, has contravened the principles to the extent that it would make them a war criminal. And this includes stuff like aggression against other nations. Now, Obama was kind of viewed as being an anti-war candidate, a dove, like a peace lover, somebody who wasn't going to run like a hawkish foreign policy. But the point was to state that he won't be any different. He will be a war criminal under standard definition, just like any of the people who preceded him. And that was the idea. It is maybe a little bit sort of jarring to some people to read it the first time, but it's basically a simple statement of truth. And if you just drill down into any of his policies, and it's getting more and more the case by the day, every word that comes out of his mouth, it really is pretty evident that this is going to be the case.
Do you think this is somewhat kind of political expediency? And I mean, sometimes people say that, you know, people are campaigning for the Democratic ticket.
Yeah.
That they campaign during the primaries a bit left, and then they go a bit centre once they're nominated. They go more centrist to try and win the general election.
Yeah.
Now that he's been elected president, is he even going more to the kind of the political centre?
Oh God, there's absolutely no doubt about it. I mean, I said like straight off the primaries that he's going to head so far right during the election campaign. I mean, it was just so obvious, and there were just drastic changes from his positions in the primaries versus positions in the actual election. I mean, one instant example was his choice of vice president. So in the primaries, he's campaigned as an anti-war candidate, anti-Iraq candidate. Who did he pick for his vice presidential candidate? One of the most hawkish pro-war senators in the U.S. Senate, Joe Biden, like one of the main guys who made the case for the invasion. Completely spitting on like his base of supporters. Now he's won the election, he's the president-elect. He's gone even further to the right in his cabinet picks, sticking with, certain members of Bush's cabinet, choosing Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, somebody whose foreign policies he decimated and criticized so heavily during the primary campaign.
Sure, yeah.
Somebody whose sort of outlook, he stated, was symptomatic of the standard Washington fare that he was trying to break away with. As soon as he becomes president, he then goes back to that fair and he brings her in and puts her in the most senior position in his cabinet. So that's an illustration of how to what degree.
That looks a little bit like Washington realpolitik. That you make a deal that back me in the presidential campaign and what's it worth to you, Secretary of State. And so it comes out that way. Yeah.
Yeah. It may well be the case. And actually, like there are a lot of people who. Who have said, he's got to do this. If he's going to get elected, he's got to do this. He's got to, he's got to elect some pro-war people. He's got to, James Jones on his as his national security advisor, who's on the board of Chevron and the board of Boeing. He's got to have these people. I think that there's a political term called institutional theory, which basically states that within the parameters of the institution. The agent has to act. You can't act outside those parameters. And people often use that as like an excuse for his actions and for what he's doing. He's got to do certain things. He's got to please the Israel lobby. But it makes no sense whatsoever because he's the one who's taken the choice to put himself within that framework. He's the one who decided he's going to get involved in politics. And so he's no less guilty than a mafia boss. A mafia boss will be in a position whereby he's got to do certain things that are bad. He's got to kill people. He's got to rob places. He's got to steal stuff.
Yeah.
You don't look at that and say, oh, but he's just got to do it because he's part of the institution. It's the way it works. No, of course not. The way it works is crooked, and you get involved in a crooked system, then you're as crooked as the system. So that excuse doesn't work.
It's a very interesting position because there are lots of people, around the world who look on the situation, having had 8 years of Bush, what you might call the bad cop, and looking at this guy as being someone completely different. And there is an enormous amount of kind of an enormous honeymoon for him. But all the crumbs, I suppose, of comfort that these people can look for is hoping that he's not really stating his real position, and that when he goes in, when he gets his feet under the table for a bit, he might really express his true feelings. Because when you actually look at his foreign policy speeches, etc., there is nothing there which is outside of the normal kind of quest for hegemonic power, quest for, imperial dominance than anything else. He certainly understands it. He certainly understands what's going on. And it will, describe, you know, say, for example, the support of a tyrant as being, you know, a complication in our quest for democracy throughout the world. So he's mindful of US atrocities. But he, you know, but he's, as you say, he's gone into that system and he doesn't really show any kind of distaste for it, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's gone back in his position with such a rapidity. I mean, one example that's cited in the article is his Palestinian views, and he he's somebody who Obama is somebody who's met Edward Said at sort of significant length. Edward Said, the most notable Palestinian scholar of the last 60 years.
Yeah.
He's somebody who's friends with Rashid Khalidi, who's a Palestinian professor at Columbia University. He's somebody who is very, very apprised of the issues surrounding the conflict. He actually said, I think 2 years ago, he was chastised because he said, quote, nobody has suffered more than the Palestinian people. He then had to renege on this and state that he meant that it was because of the Hamas leadership that they were suffering. But he's clearly someone who's apprised of the issues. But despite the fact that he is aware of what's going on and aware of the crimes and aware of the suffering, he still has the capability and the capacity to get up on a stage at AIPAC and say Jerusalem will be the undivided capital of Israel.
Sure.
He's still got the capacity to really, really sort of, sacrifice his, what I believe are probably his deep down held values and feelings and positions on certain policies and sacrifice them to whatever is the prevailing corporate interest. So he does that with a remarkable fluidity.
That AIPAC speech, I saw it recently. Have you seen the whole thing?
Yeah, I did.
It does make you kind of wince, doesn't it?
It just makes you aware of how systematic the control or how systematic the need is for high-level American politicians to align themselves with Israeli pressure groups. It's impossible for anybody to gain any level of high position in U.S. government without doing that. It's essentially, and to be a president, I mean, it's a sine qua non. You know, I mean, there's no president, even going back to Truman, I mean, there's no president who hasn't put Israel very, very high in the list of priorities.
What do you think that's down to?
And with Obama, it's all the more depressing. I mean, look, his father was a Muslim. He's had a pretty cosmopolitan and international upbringing. He's aware of the issues. He's aware of the suffering. And so the point that I raised in the article is that, okay, two things. Firstly, what does it say about him? The speed and the ease with which he can drop his positions, number one. Number two, more seriously, what does it say about the possibilities for the Palestinian people if someone like Barack Obama, Muslim father, international upbringing, you know, met Edward Said, friends with Rashid Khalidi, if someone like him isn't going to take their side, isn't going to help them out, isn't going to do what's right? It's not a question about size, actually. It's a question about doing what's right. If he's not going to do what's right, then when are we going to have a president? And what kind of president? And is it ever possible to have a president who will do what's right? That's the question that strikes me.
Yeah. In that very same speech, there's a lot of talk about the threat to Iran. And he almost does the kind of traditional American presidential candidate saying, I will defend you. I will use our military. And he talks a lot about the threat of Iran. Which, given that Iran's only had one war in my lifetime, and that was against Iraq, which was kind of supported by the West, I don't know of, Iran going to the other side of the world and invading countries like the U.S. does. What do you think of this kind of constant noise about the threat of Iran and how, he will use everything in his power to defeat the kind of Iranian threat?
Right. Well, you're right, actually. It's like a ritual. Any American politician or even maybe British politician who's going to speak to any Zionist audience, as a matter of ritual, has to say something violent against Iran. Has to say, oh, and by the way, we will obliterate Iran. By the way, we will do this. If they do that, we'll kill them. We'll kill them all. Whatever. He's got to say something really aggressive and hawkish against Iran. It's like you can't do without it. One thing that was notable, I mean, many things, but one thing that was notable was his recycling of the old story of wipe is red off the map.
Sure.
Which is just...
That old chestnut.
Oh, which is just something that's... It's just... it's so sad because it's just a drastic mistranslation, number one. Number two, it's one of the... Maybe even the prime element that's being used to beat the drum for war and for attack against Iran. And it, you know, and he's, I mean, he must know that it's not true, but he comes out there and he recycles it and repeats it to a larger public. Number three is the fact that, you know, the head of the IAEA, Mohammed Al-Baradei, has said that if anything is done to Iran, if there are any attacks that are done in the name of stopping nuclear weapons, A, he will quit because he will realize that his agency has no power and no say in anything. And number two, the Middle East will turn, in his words, into a fireball, quote, into a fireball. And, you know, absolutely, this is the guy, yeah, who's going to know better than anybody else. And yet Obama still comes out and threatens this and threatens this scenario. I mean, I just think it's so boneheaded and just so and just so imprudent. And it's just symptomatic of the slavishness with which, you know, high-level American politicians prostrate themselves in front of Israeli interests.
Is it just Israeli interest, though? Because you look specifically at Iran, and it's a complex subject, so we shouldn't oversimplify it. But, you know, if you look at this story with the access to a map, and you look at what the U.S. has done in the last eight and further years in terms of putting military bases in the stands, as it were, around Afghanistan. Yeah. And basically having Iran essentially surrounded, that kind of mineral resource-rich part of the world with troops all over the place, it's fairly obvious what they really want, which is control of a key, you know, a key strategic carbon resource.
Yeah, no, I think I was being a little bit oversimplified there. When I say prostrating themselves in front of Israeli interests,
sure,
I don't buy the Stephen Walt and the John Mearsheimer line, which is that you know, that America sacrifices its own interests for Israeli interests. I don't think that's the case at all.
No evidence of that.
What I mean is that there, when there's a conflation of the interests, what I mean is that, I guess essentially America sees its interests as being, or Israel's interests as being conflated with America's. So a healthy, a powerful, and dominant Israel is good for America.
Sure, it's part of their
It's an American proxy state and an important part of the world. So when I say prostrating myself in that sense, I mean in that sense, not at America's expense. I don't believe that's the
case. He's a complex character in the sense that he does say a lot of things which left liberal and kind of lovers of peace would like to hear. And then he goes off and says something like, we have to deal with the threat of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now, you know, any interview with kind of leading people in Iraq would say, what Al-Qaeda in Iraq? What are you talking about? There is an Iraqi resistance. None of us have ever heard of this Al-Qaeda in Iraq. He's a slippery character in the sense that he says a lot of good things. Yes, the threat to the United States was completely exaggerated by the Bush regime for their own purposes. And then, for someone like you, or for someone like I, who's looked into this whole war on terror thing and sees it, I think quite properly, as being an excuse for imperial moves, he recites those kind of pretty ludicrous positions, you know, talking about phantoms, as if they were gospel truth. It's, you find it hard to kind of get a handle on him, because on one hand he's saying things which are critical of the regime, critical of the U.S. policy, demonstrate understanding of it, and then says something like, you know, we have to, you know, use troops to surround Father Christmas, as it were, the equivalent.
Well, I think that has been said about him. The one thing that's characterized his rise to power is his sort of chameleon-like ability to adapt himself to any environment that he's in. So he can be like the human rights person when he's working as a community organizer. He can be the pro-Palestinian when he's doing stuff with them. He can be the Zionist when he's in front of AIPAC. And when he's talking about the war on terror or the war in Iraq, I mean, it's indispensable you've got to talk about the fight against Al-Qaeda in Iraq. You're fighting Al-Qaeda. I actually have a friend who's an officer who served 6 months in Basra, and he said that nothing annoys him more when he hears people talking about fighting against Al-Qaeda in Iraq. It's not Al-Qaeda. You're fighting against a load of pissed off people who want you to get out of your country.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And who happen to be Muslims, and to the extent with which Muslims who hate, you know, American occupation or Al-Qaeda, they're Al-Qaeda, but they're not Al-Qaeda. I mean, it's just complete nonsense. And so I think that's just reflective of his sort of awareness of the fact that, you know, there are certain buzzwords that have got to be said. I don't believe that he believes it, you know, that he believes it really. But like, more broadly speaking on the war on terror, I think it's useful to look at what his sort of overall positions are. Now, he, the most common sort of myth about Obama, and one thing that, you know, I try and quite forcefully sort of repudiate in the article, is that he is going to end the war in Iraq. He is not going to end the war in Iraq. This is so important for people to understand. The occupation is not going to end under him. Even if you look at his most sort of dovish speeches, he has never, and if you look at his policy documents, he has never said one thing about touching or doing anything to remove the 180,000 private contractors who are there, many of whom are military contractors. So right now you have thousands of private mercenary soldiers who are in Iraq.
Sure.
And who inspires massive hatred amongst the Iraqis because they're completely unaccountable. You look at the Nisour Square massacre 2 years ago, where Blackwater Guards opened fire and basically murdered 17 just innocent Iraqi civilians in broad daylight. And he hasn't said he's going to do anything about them, even when pressed on it. He says also, even in the best long-term scenario, he's only going to leave sufficient troops to guard diplomatic personnel and to, like, a residual force to strike at Al-Qaeda wherever they may be in Iraq. Well, one thing that he doesn't mention is that there are 20,000 American diplomatic staff in Iraq in the Green Zone in Baghdad right now. So you're going to need a hell of a lot of troops who are still going to be there. That's number one.
Sure.
And number two, yeah, you're going to have your residual force striking at Al-Qaeda. I mean, but come on, like, you know, how many are they going to be? So even under the best case scenario, and this is assuming that Obama enacts the best case scenario that he's outlined, Samantha Power, who was his former foreign policy advisor, she quit the campaign after she called Hillary Clinton a monster. But his former foreign policy advisor said, after she quit the campaign, yes, we talk about leaving Iraq, but that's only in the best case scenario. It may well be the case that we need to stay. So, you know, even granting him, like, even granting him the benefit of the doubt, there's just no way that he's going to be ending the occupation of Iraq. And what he is going to do with the people that he draws down, lots of them aren't going to just go home, they're going to go to Afghanistan. And, you know, he plays on the notion of Afghanistan being the good war. This is really, really sort of insidious. Afghanistan was no more a good war than Iraq was. The Taliban warned America on the 27th of August. It was reported in The Guardian and in Reuters that the Taliban warned the U.S. pre-9/11 that Al-Qaeda were plotting a big attack against them. After 9/11 happened, they came out and said, look, if you have proof against Osama bin Laden, we're happy to hand him over. America didn't want to give the proof over, and now on the FBI's website, bin Laden isn't wanted for 9/11.
Sure.
So the war against Afghanistan is no more just than the war against Iraq. And also, it seems to be the notion that, look, this is one thing that hasn't been brought up in any sort of circles of discussion that I've seen. It's the notion that, okay, Iraq has gone really badly. What we now need to do is go into Afghanistan. But there's no sort of sense of why is Afghanistan going to go any better than Iraq, even if it was a more just war, which it isn't. Even if it was, why does that mean that Afghanistan will go better? How is it not going to be a quagmire? The problem is that when you invade a country and occupy a country that doesn't want to be occupied, you're never going to win. Like the Brits know, we know that from Afghanistan and Iraq. The Brits have known that in Iraq since 1920, and they've known it in Afghanistan since hundreds of years. So this whole premise that we're going to go to Afghanistan and that'll be the good war and everything's going to be okay, is just nonsense, and it's not been analysed to any sort of depth.
What I have seen of his kind of more broad of his foreign policy statements in terms of his kind of his outlook is kind of, it's very, very reminiscent of Zbigniew Brzezinski in that it's much more, yes, let's use our military power, but let's make sure we do it in the context of a multinational action. Yeah. He's by no means, and anyone who thinks he is a peacenik simply isn't paying attention. But it is much more the kind of the multinational viewpoint, the multinational thing, a bit like, say, for example, the NATO move on Yugoslavia. But the problem with that is that if when you analyze the works of someone like Brzezinski, who I believe does advise in some capacity, when you actually look at their work, it's explicitly imperial. It's saying, you know, we're in a position to be the primary force or to achieve primacy in the world, and let's go out and do it. And if we need to do it, if we need to get some allies together to do it, let's do it that way. We need to conquer Central Asia. Let's do it that way. So the idea of this guy coming in just to bring peace and prosperity, it's just kind of ludicrous.
Well, firstly, you're right. Yeah, Brzezinski is one of Obama's advisors. The second point is that, yeah, you just need to read Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard.
Sure.
I mean, just the title says it all. It's The Grand Chessboard. It's a game, it's a geostrategic game that needs to be played in order to secure dominance and, I guess, to conquer your opponents.
It's very interesting because it's very interesting in its explicitness because it says the Roman Empire was this big, the British Empire was this big, and, you know, if we get our act together, ours could be this big.
Interesting because if you read the sort of mindset behind these books, you've got to read Machiavelli's The Prince. There, obviously, the book was denounced when it came out. He was compared to the devil, so on and so forth. But and even today, Machiavellian is it's a term that has very sort of significant and very negative undertones. But if you read that book and you compare the principle, if you read that book and you read Brzezinski's book or you read Kissinger's memoirs or anything like that, you'll see the principles applied in Machiavelli are exactly the same principles as those that are applied by the likes of Kissinger and Brzezinski. It's just that I guess that, you know, we can look at Machiavelli and we can put him in one box, but it's a different box to the one in which we put our statesmen. The people that we see on the BBC and CNN are venerable people like Kissinger and Brzezinski.
Yeah.
But it's exactly the same principle, is that, you know, we need to secure dominance. If we're going to secure dominance, we need to do this. We need to wage these wars here. We need to be friends with these dictators here. The most important thing is that we do this. And all under the predicate which isn't argued at all. Actually, in Brzezinski's book, he spends, I think, half a page or one page just outlining and quasi-justifying his predicate, which is that American global domination is good for everybody. So as long as America dominates the world, everyone's going to be happy.
Everyone's going to be
happy. Which is just something that nobody can take seriously.
It kind of brings me to the idea of a character like Obama being someone who is great PR for the United States, because with the characters like Brzezinski and Kissinger and people like that, foreign policy speakers or thinkers who may appear on Newsnight, there is pretty much always this two-track discourse. There's one for kind of general public consumption, your BBC One News at 10, that, you know, we want to spread democracy and spread freedom and all the rest of it. And there is another for those who might read, you know, Foreign Affairs, which is by the Council on Foreign Relations, or in a book like Brzezinski's book, saying, well, look, you know, American primacy is good for everybody. Let's go out and conquer the world. And you do wonder whether this quite charismatic, this charismatic leader wasn't spotted at some point by someone as someone who could do, you know, a good job in terms of being good PR for the empire.
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt about it. I mean, there's a reason why he's received so much in donations from big corporations. There's absolutely no doubt about it. What he will do, very simply, is he will cloak imperialist policies and postures in a benign image, in like a benign cloak. So people will, kind of like Bill Clinton did.
Sure,
people looked
at
Kosovo and so on and so forth, and even the bombing of the Sudan pharmaceutical factory, and they were like, oh, you know, it's it's not the worst thing in the world. I mean, Kosovo was viewed as like being a humanitarian mission, you know, which is just like an astonishing distortion of the facts and of history. And you'll see the same thing under Obama, because he projects like a very benign and very unifying public image. The policies don't change. The policies don't change significantly. Maybe there'll be some humanitarian stuff thrown in here and there, but the policies won't change. And nobody will criticize him, because the public are so anesthetized when it comes to him. And this is one real danger. I mean, he did very well in his community organizing and so on and so forth, which he basically used to mobilize funds and effectively win the presidency. But there's one danger, and that's that he has this such a big and such enthusiastic popular base. And I get the feeling that this popular base is going to do what he wants them to do. So there's lots of talk about we need to put pressure on Obama, we need to put pressure on him. But I don't think that's going to happen from his popular base. I think they're so enthralled. I think there's such a degree of thrall around him.
They're such good willing, you know.
Yeah, that I think that they're not going to be able to. They're not going to have a proper perspective on the stuff that he's doing. And this is actually a very, very interesting point about his support. So Obama has two levels of support. He has the sort of plutocracy, the corporatocracy above, and the sort of populist, like the grassroots stuff from down below. And they've basically contributed significantly to his campaign. But the dynamics of each one are radically different. So with the corporatocracy, their financial support of him is contingent on him doing what they tell him to do, okay? But so they tell him what to do, whereas Obama and the popular support, the people aren't telling him what to do, he's telling the people what to do.
Go knock on some doors for me.
Yeah, go and knock on some doors. So if you imagine that sort of trickle effect, it's the corporations telling Obama what to do, and Obama is then telling his mass grassroots base what to do. So effectively you have, you can almost have a situation where you have, you know, big corporations what you do have is you have a situation where big corporations who have a guy in their hands who has like a mass popular support in his hands. So indirectly the corporations could be controlling sort of, you know, grassroots movements in the sense that, you know, they can wrap their policies up in, you know, nice sort of Barack Obama cloak and present them to the public, and the public will swallow them quite happily, and that's very, very dangerous.
A more credible salesman. A couple of questions there, and observations. One is that, in terms of selling any particular war, that this new character, this new sympathetic character, charismatic guy, really great speaker, erudite, all the rest of it, is a much better salesman for these wars than your outgoing George Bush. But from a certain perspective, having George Bush being the front of the American empire has been beneficial to those who want to organize against it, because it's so transparent that he's not interested in spreading democracy or in the fate of Iraqi children and all the rest of it. He's such a bad actor that it's clear he doesn't care about it. So in actual fact, if you're interested in peace, you're better, in a strange way, you're better off with someone who's a clear warmonger like Bush than someone who emotes and looks the part and all the rest of it, but is committed to the same ideology.
Under a certain perspective, that's true. Under a certain perspective, that's very, very true. You know, liberals and progressives are more than, they don't need a second invitation to criticize George Bush, which is absolutely fine, absolutely correct. Barack Obama, on the other hand, I really think that there are significant sways on the left that are going to be kind of that are anesthetized in front of him. I mean, I went to an event went on the election night in Paris, held by the Republicans and Democrats abroad. Any American who goes abroad is never going to be a Republican. So it was basically Barack Obama headquarters. And everyone there was just delirious when he won, like, I mean, hysterical, lots of people crying, going absolutely crazy. And these are the sorts of people who I think aren't going to be able to have the capacity or the perspective to offer, like, honest critiquing of his policies. And when I say it, and that comes back to what I said about the danger of Barack Obama, is that, you know, he really does sort of reframe the discourse. He actually said something very interesting at the start of the primary campaign. He said, in America, the rough paraphrase, in America you have Rush Limbaugh on the right and you have NPR on the left. Where we want to be is somewhere in the middle. So, you know what I mean? The fact that he sees NPR as being the leftmost, sort of, the left end of the spectrum of public discourse, and it's something that we need to be far removed from. It kind of shows automatically where his sort of perspective and his framework for action lies.
Okay, thanks, Mo. I'd like to leave with end on a quote from the man we're discussing himself, which says, as you can comment on this, "I serve as a blank screen on which people of vastly different political stripes project their own views. I am bound to disappoint some, if not all of them."
Well, he's very honest, and he's very correct. I mean, this has been one of the main factors in his election success. He can appeal to white people, to black people, to Muslim people, to men, to women, to gays, to straights, to whoever. That's absolutely true. But it's also kind of reflective of his own, I think, of his own sort of chameleon style nature, in that whichever sort of environment, political or non-political environment that he's sort of immersed in, he has the capacity to adapt himself to whatever are the exigencies that situation requires. And I think now we're seeing him in a situation where the exigencies are very clear, their militarism, their imperialism, so on and so forth, their corporatocracy, their plutocracy, and he's very, very capable of adapting himself to the demands that are going to be placed on him by those interests. And so, I mean, I think that when we're sitting here talking about this in either 4 or 8 years, we're going to be looking back on a presidency that, I mean, initially I said that, you know, he may be sort of like another Jimmy Carter. I said that sort of 6 to 12 months ago, he may be another Jimmy Carter. But I don't think he's even going to be that sort of liberal, that dovish. I think we're going to see Bill Clinton-style policies, but within a George Bush sort of framework. So if Bill Clinton had been in power during the war on terror, we'd have seen obviously much more aggression than we saw from the 90s. I think we're going to see that sort of level of militarism. I think that lots of people are going to die under an Obama administration. I think that there's going to be no resolution to the Middle East peace process. I think you're going to see terrorism attacks that you had in Mumbai, for example. I think that's going to continue because Obama doesn't see or doesn't want to combat the true cause of global terrorism, which is American terrorism and American oppression. And I think that you're going to see a situation in 4 to 8 years where I'm not really too sure it's going to be that different from the situation.
It will just have a different salesman.
Different salesman, yeah, I would think so.
Well, for the sake of vulnerable people around the world, you know, you studied your books and you've checked your references, as I know you always do. But let's hope we're both wrong about all this and it turns out to be the dovish presidency that people who haven't bothered to read the books or look at the articles or listen to the speeches believe it will be.
I think the most important thing, just one last thing, is that anybody listening to this, anybody who's a big Obama fan, fine, be a big fan, that's actually not a problem, but have the capacity to detach yourself from the hysteria and to analyze his policies dispassionately, because him continuing the war in Afghanistan or escalating the war in Afghanistan or continuing the war in Iraq is as much of a crime and as repulsive and as reprehensible as it would be if it were George Bush or John McCain doing it. It makes no difference.
Thanks, Mohsin.
Thank you.
I will look forward to reading more of your missives from your blog, Daily Mohsin, and we'll speak to you soon.
Cheers. Take care.
Take care.